Okay, what have I got today? I've got two Palestinian voices and an Israeli dissident voice, so I'm continuing it on. Amy Goodman has a piece about ghettoizing with an analogy that will be uncomfortable for some, which is the Warsaw Ghetto. That's her Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, and I found out that I skipped a Mumia commentary, so I am trying to get that on the air right away. It's kind of, fits in our last bit of discourse about our exile to Scotland. I hope he stays. Yeah. Thanks for supporting community media. Thanks for listening. Let's see. Prairie Crossroads Blues Fest. There's a blues band playing today, and it's mild out. It's the same time as this gathering in the park of my ex. Well, I'm still a member. I'm a retired member of the SEIU union, service employees. That's why I've got a pension and all. And why don't I get an underwriting announcement in right now, despite the fact juggling things. I'm going to get that theme for you guys to click, so we have a smoother transition, which is something from Chomsky. By the way, Noam Chomsky is on the contact list of Epstein. He wasn't a client list person, but he actually intervened, wanted to have Epstein intervene with him on his behalf to get him in touch with some labor politicians in Israel who he knew that Epstein was connected to, not making any other further insinuation there or anything about them. But apparently while he was there, he also had a transaction done, which I guess if you don't meet many hedge fund people and this guy's congenial and says, well, is there anything I can do for you, Noam? Well, let me facilitate this transaction. So that's the way I understand it. There, Amy Goodman has a piece on the contact of Chomsky from the archives. I thought about playing it, but not so much. Here is Mumia Abu-Jamal with a cultural reference that I understand.
Yes, this is Sheikh Bilal Abdul-Salam Bey, a prisoner at the Hutchinson.
If I just say what's on my mind, I know that people of a certain generation, shall we say under 40, will not get the reference that I'm about to make. But if you're 50 and over, you will, and maybe it'll give you a chuckle, but it's not meant to give you a chuckle. It's meant to make you reflect, to make you think, and hopefully to make you shudder a little bit. Imagine Archie Bunker becoming president of the United States. I'm not talking about Carol O'Connor. I'm talking about the character, Archie Bunker. The same sensibilities. Let's say that he won a lottery and won millions of dollars and ran and got elected president of the U.S. Twice, even. That would give you some sense of what we're looking at in this mad, mad world of today. You know, Archie Bunker was, in his own way, a character with a certain cuteness about him. But imagine that under that cuteness was a kind of dread and a love of cruelty and a kind of terror of the world changing and becoming something else. That's what we're looking at every day, every morning, every headline. We're looking at the rule of incompetence. Archie Bunker was many things, but he wasn't a smart dude. He also feared others who he thought were different. What makes us less different, what makes us parts of community, is our humanity. And that means that all of us are part of the same motion of human. We're all human. And believe it or not, we're all related. So we're all family. We're part of the human family. There's very little to fear from that. But fear, still, rules the day, and unfortunately the night. That's the world we're living in, Archie Bunker, without the chuckles. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
That's quite a punctuation mark there, isn't it? Okay. Cooperation here with the equipment. Let's see. Amy Goodman's up next. Why don't we do it this way? Oh, well, actually, come to think of it, I said I was going to play this underwriting announcement, then I didn't, so let's make a unliar of me.
Programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Common Ground Food Co-op. Located in Lincoln Square Mall, Common Ground is Champaign-Urbana's only community-owned grocery store specializing in local and organic foods. All are welcome and no membership is required to shop at the Common Ground Food Co-op.
Programming on WEFT.
Starvation as a Weapon of War. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. In 1516, a seven-acre section of Venice, Italy, was designated as the area where Jews would be required to live. As it was located where a copper foundry had been, it was called by the word for foundry in the Venetian dialect, ghetto. The practice of forcibly concentrating Jews into such ghettos grew, reaching a brutal, murderous climax under the Nazi regime in the 1930s and 40s. The hundreds of ghettos and cities they occupied, creating a system of oppression that for most Jews led to death on the street or deportation to death camps like Treblinka. The Warsaw Ghetto was the most notorious Nazi ghetto. Germany invaded Poland on September 1, 1939, and within a year, it constructed the walled ghetto. Close to 500,000 Jews were imprisoned there. Those who attempted to escape were shot on sight. Germany immediately restricted food and medicine, leading to starvation and disease. Images of the desperation were actually filmed by Nazi propagandists. Four reels of silent film footage were found in East Germany years after the war. It appears in the 2010 documentary A Film Unfinished. The footage juxtaposes fabricated scenes of wealthy Warsaw Jews enjoying comfortable lives, while outside, people dressed in rags beg and others collect the dead from the street. The propaganda film was never completed, hence the documentary's title. But the images of suffering provide a rare look at the inhumanity of the Nazi ghetto. That was 1942. Now, in 2025, there's another embattled enclave where people of one ethnicity are imprisoned, dying of starvation and disease, shot on sight if they try to escape. This is Gaza, a manufactured hell on earth that can only be described as a ghetto. This comparison is not new. 2 months after Hamas's October 7, 2023, surprise attack on Israel, The New Yorker published an essay by M. Gessen titled In the Shadow of the Holocaust. In it, Gessen makes the comparison between Jewish ghettos under the Nazis and conditions in Gaza. Explaining the point on the Democracy Now! News Hour at the time, Gessen said,
the similarities are so substantial that they can actually inform our understanding of what's happening now. And what's happening now, and this is probably the line in the piece that made a lot of people throw their laptops across the room, what's happening now is that the ghetto is being liquidated. And I think that's an important thing to say, not just because it's important to call things, to describe things in the best possible way that we can, but because, again, in the name of never again, we have to ask if this is like a ghetto, and if what we're witnessing now in this indiscriminate killing, in this in an onslaught that has displaced almost all the people of Gaza, that has made them homeless, if that is substantially similar to what we saw in some places during the Holocaust, then what is the world going to do about it? What is the world going to do in the name of never again?
Israeli-American scholar Omer Bartov Brown University professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, told Democracy Now! Of the increasing consensus among academics that Israel's attack on Gaza amounts to genocide. He described Israel's plan to build a quote-unquote humanitarian city to house 600,000 Palestinians there as
a sort of combination of ghetto and concentration camp that would be built, as he said, on the ruins of Rafah. The state of Israel publicly is speaking about the creation of a vast concentration camp whose goal is removal of the population.
Well over 100 Palestinians in Gaza have starved to death and counting. Michael Fakhry, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, said on Democracy Now!
This is the fastest famine we've seen, the fastest starvation campaign we've seen in modern history.
The UN's aid distribution has been essentially shut down, replaced with the shadowy U.S. and Israeli-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Palestinians swarm the inadequate sites seeking food. Over 1,000 have been killed there so far, fired upon by the Israeli military and U.S. mercenaries. Mahmoud Al-Saka, Oxfam's emergency food security lead in Gaza, appeared on Democracy Now! Having himself lost over 30 pounds during Israel's war on Gaza.
This happening in front of all the world, while the world, all the world are watching this heartbreaking and without having a concrete action.
The Warsaw Ghetto's Jews launched an uprising, temporarily halting the death camp deportations. By mid-1943, the uprising had been crushed, the remaining ghetto residents killed. Monuments to the ghetto and the uprising dot Warsaw now. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu want all Palestinians removed from Gaza in what would be a criminal act of mass ethnic cleansing. Trump wants the U.S. to own Gaza and build what he calls the Riviera of the Middle East. There are more than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza ghetto, now more than ever in need of food, aid, solidarity, and action from us all. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And access to their land so they can grow their food. They were actually growing a lot of their own, not staples, but fruits, vegetables. Okay. Let's see. We'll start with Brian Edwards Tiekert of Corona Calls. He has this situation where he's gotten recently COVID for the second time. This new variety apparently might have more asymptomatic people involved. He finds that he was infected by somebody on a hiking trip who had no symptoms at all. So, but in the after the fact, they found out that's how it happened. Anyway, Corona Calls is available as a freestanding podcast. You can hear it on Upfront, which is the name of the show that he does, and I go to it quite frequently lately because he has great rapport with a lot of different kinds of guests. This guest is in from, as he'll tell you, normally in Jerusalem at Al-Quds University, but here contacted in Cairo, perhaps visiting relatives, I don't know. Right, here's that segment. Then Flashpoints with fairly regular guest Sam Husseini. Gonna look up. This segment is as well. I'll let Brian do the introduction, and then Ilan Pape from 4 months ago would be more somber if it was recorded now. But there's still quite a good material in it, and this is sort of a teaser because I intend to play a whole hour of him tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Ilan Pape. Most recent book is called Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. And it starts out with a sort of very beginnings, but spends a fair amount of time on how the Balfour document came around in the UK. It's a fair amount, and it was recorded in the UK at in Hackney Downs, or Heckney, borough that's probably gentrified by now. I probably wouldn't recognize it. Happened to see a concert on the Hackney Downs. That's probably why it spit it out. Anyway, here's Brian Edwards Tiekert. A lot of people throw their laptops across the room.
Start this morning with the horrifying situation in Gaza. The World Food Program came out this week saying the hunger crisis had reached, quote, new and astonishing levels of desperation. In their estimation, A third of the population is not eating for multiple days in a row. And it is in this context that security forces with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the organization stood up by Israel to supplant the arm of the United Nations that formerly provided humanitarian relief in Gaza and the occupied territories, that security forces with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation have been firing into crowds at food distribution points, killing dozens at a time. We thought it would be worth taking a breath to engage with the implications in international law. One of the fronts that supporters of Palestinian rights have been plugging away on for years now, while only very occasionally bursting into the news headlines. We're joined by Munir Nuzeba. He's a human rights lawyer and an assistant professor at Al-Quds University Law School in Jerusalem, where he directs the Al-Quds Human Rights Clinic. He's speaking to us from Egypt. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I thought we could start with the news of the starvation that is spreading across Gaza. This is a humanitarian crisis moving faster than legal proceedings typically do. But what are the legal implications of these kinds of declarations from the World Food Program?
The starvation that Israel is intentionally inflicting upon all of the civilian population in the Gaza Strip can be seen legally from different angles. On the one hand, it's certainly a war crime. Using starvation as a weapon of war is defined as a war crime by the Geneva Convention, but also by the Rome Statute. And maybe it's worthwhile here to remind that the International Criminal Court has already issued arrest warrants against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for using starvation as a method of war against the civilian population in Gaza. So this is one angle to see it. But the other angle, which is not less important, is genocide. As there is consensus today among all the scholars of genocide, as well as a number of special rapporteurs from the United Nations, the Commission of Inquiry in the United Nations, and other experts, that Israel is perpetrating the crime of genocide in the Gaza Strip at the time when, you know, and one of the tools that Israel is using for genocide is starvation. Of course, it's not the only tool. It's also using carpet bombing. It's also using a severe torture that leads to either the deaths or the, you know, or the affects the health of the prisoners. It's using a total destruction of every aspect of life in the Gaza Strip, including schooling, including culture, including businesses. Everything is paralyzed today in Gaza, and all of this is amounting to genocide. But starvation is probably one of the most important elements of the Israeli genocide, because it actually touches each and every one in Gaza Strip. Even if you are wealthy in Gaza Strip today, there is no food in the market to buy anymore. And not to mention everybody who has lost their income sources, which means that they are unable to buy anything if it's even available in the market. Israel has caused an unprecedented humanitarian disaster in the Gaza Strip, which can be very easily resolved. There are tons of humanitarian aid and goods at the Egyptian side of the Rafah crossing, which is the crossing that links Egypt to Palestine, you know, Gaza to Egypt. But Israel is preventing that amount of humanitarian aid from accessing the Gaza Strip. And therefore, goods and basic needs, including food and water, but also other basic needs like sanitary products and, you know, and everything else that you might think about, is prevented from getting to Gaza, which is causing an unprecedented humanitarian situation. I've talked recently to a lady in the Gaza Strip, asked her, how are you? How do you feel? And she said that she and her children are starving. They cannot find anything to eat. They are, you know, feeling humiliated. They don't enjoy their basic dignity. And she told me something that really shocked me, that she wishes that she and her children can be bombed and die at the same moment, because she feels that this might be the only way to rest from this torture of hunger. This is the situation as it seems to have reached in the Gaza Strip. It's very painful, and I don't know how something like this can continue to happen in this century, right? I mean, you would assume that the world has developed in a way that such atrocities cannot happen in front of us, but actually they are happening, and we all know about them. They are very well covered by media and social media and UN reports and expert reports and NGOs on the ground. They are very well covered, but, you know, everybody is watching, and we're unable to stop and reverse this atrocity.
There's been a long-running and slow-moving genocide proceeding against Israel that was brought by South Africa and the International Court of Justice. How do these more recent declarations from the World Food Programme enter that proceeding?
They are very important because at the end of the day, the fact that South Africa is using to prove the Israeli genocidal intent and genocidal action have to be collected by actors on the ground. Obviously, South Africa does not have immediate presence in the Gaza Strip. It cannot investigate everything on its own, and that's why South Africa relies on international reports, whether from UN agencies or from other sources, in order to demonstrate to the court that what is happening in the Gaza Strip is indeed a genocide, and eventually be able to ask for remedies for these crimes. But of course, the proceeding of the case of South Africa versus Israel on genocide will take several years. South Africa knew that from the beginning, and that's why South Africa requested that the court would provide provisional measures that, and that it would order Israel to stop all genocidal actions. Indeed, the court has responded already three times to the requests of South Africa for provisional measures, and the court has indeed issued three sets of provisional measures. Some of them were specifically about free access of humanitarian aid and, you know, and goods and services into the Gaza Strip. So the court has done its part when it comes to allowing humanitarian aid. It asked Israel to report back. Israel has been violating the court's orders, ignoring them totally. And therefore, it's very important now that we move from the point where there are legal orders from the court towards enforcement. Of course, the court itself does not have direct and immediate enforcement mechanisms. The court is, at the end of the day, the court of the United Nations, and it is up to the state members of the United Nations to enforce the orders of the court if a party decides not to comply. It's very clear that Israel refuses to comply with the international law, as well as international or orders of the International Court of Justice. Of course, also the International Criminal Court, and this means that each and every state in the world must take action in order to enforce this law and in order to make sure that these atrocities cannot continue to happen.
The fact that Israel has so willfully and obviously ignored these provisional measures that have been issued by the International Court of Justice does raise the question, what good is international law? If none of the great powers want to hold Israel to account, then it seems like the actual state of international law is just might makes right.
Unfortunately, this is the only message that we can understand until today that might makes right, and that if countries like the United States and France and the UK and Germany and others are supporting Israel during its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip, that this genocide will continue. This is the only lesson we can learn. But also, there are other countries in the world that are trying to send a different message. For example, there has been a group called the Hague Group that has been formed in January 2025, and they have met also recently in July, just a week ago. They met in Colombia, Bogota, and they, a number of countries decided that they will take measures against Israel. South Africa was one of them, but there were other states as well. Colombia, Bolivia, Cuba, etc. There were a number of states that decided to take action. These countries have decided, for example, an arms embargo on Israel. How can you continue to allow weapons to be transferred to Israel while you know that these weapons will be used in war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide? They also decided that they will not allow their ports to be used for any arms transfer to Israel. They decided that they will not allow any ships that carry their flag to transport weapons to Israel, and that they would deflag these ships should they not comply with their decisions. They took some practical steps, and this is what has been missing. Yes, there is no international police that can enforce international law immediately. However, it's also important that every country takes whatever measures that it can take in order to make sure that it's doing its part in the enforcement of international law. No state should think that well, if I'm not going to do it, then someone else will do it, and the genocide will continue. This is the wrong way of thinking, because at the end of the day, international law does not only create obligations vis-a-vis Israel, the country that is perpetrating the genocide and the other crimes, but also it creates and establishes obligations for each and every state in the world that might be related in one way or another to Israel and might be able to tell Israel and demonstrate that this genocide cannot continue and that they will not be complicit and that they will not be aiding or abetting such a genocide at the end of the day. The reality is Israel cannot commit this genocide and all of these crimes if it was on its own. It can only perpetrate these crimes because of the support that it is enjoying from the world and most importantly from countries like the United States.
I want to talk for a minute about that Hague group process. There's more than 30 countries that participated in the talks in Bogota last week. Only 12 of them signed on to the measures you outlined, measures to prevent the transfer of arms to Israel. Unclear whether any of those countries actually have played a role in transferring arms to Israel in the past. Also, things that look like divestment measures, measures to prevent public institutions from supporting Israel's illegal occupation. And finally, one bullet point was support of universal jurisdiction, presumably meaning they would arrest Netanyahu if he came into their countries because of the outstanding arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. What's holding the other countries at these talks back? Like, what is the process of expanding the number of countries that are signed on to concrete measures?
I think we are expecting more to join the concrete measures, especially in September 2025. And this is because in September 2024, the United Nations General Assembly basically built on the advisory opinion that the International Court of Justice had issued in July 2024. The advisory opinion had said that the whole Israeli occupation of the occupied Palestinian territory is illegal and it has to be terminated. So the General Assembly met in September and decided that, instructed Israel to terminate its occupation within 12 months, which will expire this September 2025. And that...
This is the occupation of not just Gaza, but the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Exactly. So now that Israel... Not only is Israel not complying with this, but as you can see, Israel is also displacing Palestinians, continuing with the genocide, deciding to annex more territory from the West Bank and demolishing Palestinian homes and towns and refugee camps on a continuous basis. So some countries have indicated that they will take concrete measures in September 2025. So, you know, around a month and a half from now, we should be noticing an increased number of states taking more concrete measures, whether in the framework of the Hague Group, which I think will be a very powerful framework, or with the framework of the UN General Assembly itself. There will be more concrete measures taken by states because that's a deadline that the General Assembly gave last year. So, of course, the question is how many countries are going to join the concrete steps? The example that the Hague Group has set, which includes no transfer of weapons and some types of divestment and accountability, whether in the International Criminal Court or using universal jurisdiction, which means using their own domestic legal frameworks to prosecute not only Netanyahu, but also any other person who is accused of war crimes or crimes against humanity perpetrated in Palestine. So that's a wide scope of using law in order to bring about accountability to criminals. I believe that more states will be joining in September. Of course, the sooner the better. And I don't know why states have to wait until September. It's not like we really expect that Israel will comply by the UN General Assembly resolution by September. But you know, that's what they have decided. And and I'm hoping that in September there will be more states, more measures taken. And it really depends on international diplomacy as well as international advocacy to see how many states will join and what types of measures are they going to take. But it's very important for each state to know that whatever measures they take, they are only complying with their international legal obligations. A country that is currently arming Israel can be held liable for this. It is very clear that Israel is at least According to what the court said, the International Court of Justice said that it's plausible that Israel is committing genocide. So at least you can think of a risk of genocide if you don't want to believe and approve that there is a genocide coming. If you're still waiting for a few years from now until the court has made its final decision, you already know that the court has said that genocide is plausible and it decided to take measures against Israel. Provisional measures against Israel. So this means that every country around the world knows that Israel is committing crimes. We also know, of course, of the arrest warrants of the International Criminal Court. And this, this means as well that they can be liable if they continue to arm Israel and to fund Israel at a time when these crimes are happening. So these countries would be when they abide and adopt these measures, they would be, on the one hand, on a much better and stronger moral position, but also, on the other hand, they would be protecting their own countries, their own systems, their own economies from any liability that stems from their arming of Israel at the time of genocide and war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Munir, I'm going to ask you to stay with us. 5732.
That's Munir. Okay, I don't have his name in front of me, and I thought Brian Edwards Secret would add that. That's who that was. That's from Upfront episode. It's on a podcast just as Upfront. And had to move up, increase the volume of his voice. He's suffering from second bout of COVID while doing a show about COVID every Monday. It was quite poignant. Let's go on to Sam Husseini, second Palestinian, and we'll close it with parts of a talk that was recorded in Hackney in the UK 4 months ago. I missed it, but I'll be presenting most of it tomorrow. I don't know what to edit out. Maybe his personal reflections or maybe some of the manifold stuff about the UK, though I don't know. Maybe the UK would be good to examine. Sam Husseini is notable for calling for the General Assembly to use a provision to intervene. There is a provision to go around the Security Council, and the latest call is it's time to invoke the Genocide Convention, which Roots Action and World Beyond War are advocating for. So you can look for that if you want. I think he might mention it here, but let's see.
Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every day at 5 o'clock. We speak truth to power on this beautiful radio network invented in 1949 by folks who understood how important it was to have free speech and a free voice to the people. So what an honor it is. And we begin today, of course, where we left off yesterday. We're talking about the slaughter and the genocide, the expanding genocide, which now includes daily starvations of people who are being starved to death based on U.S. policy and Israeli policy. What a deadly collaboration. Sam Husseini joins us from Washington, D.C. He is our special correspondent who goes to the State Department, tries to ask questions, sometimes gets wounded in the process. Sam, welcome back to Flashpoints. These are extremely terrible times on the ground in Gaza. Starvation is a weapon of war. You're now calling for support of an armed UN force to protect the people. Tell us about, give us a little background. Where are we now on the ground in Gaza? Why is it important to have an armed force to protect these people?
Thanks so much for having me on, Dennis, and for all that Flashpoints does. Well, it's not just me who's calling for it. We've had, for example, possibly the most prominent person who's been calling for it is Michael Fakiri. He's been warning for several months now. He's the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food. And, he's been warning of genocide and starvation for well over a year. And over the last several months, he has increased his calls for some kind of protection force to ensure that that the aid gets in, because Israel not only is stopping aid from getting in, but the little aid that they've gotten in, I'm sure your listeners or a lot of your listeners are aware of this so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that the U.S. and Israeli governments have set up, whereby they are, put out aid and then basically lure Palestinians in there, and then they shoot them, tase them, tear gas them. You've had upwards of 1,000 people being killed just in the process of trying to get aid. Now we're seeing 100 people being killed every day. You know, when Israel only does 80 a day, it's like a subpar day. But the newest thing is that we are seeing, you know, increasingly mass deaths from starvation. We're seeing, you know, 10, 20 people starting to drop, dying from starvation. And the special rapporteur on food has been warning about this back in May. He warned if aid doesn't enter Gaza now, 1,400 babies may die. UN peacekeepers must step in. And then the following month in June, he implored send in UN armed troops to protect aid convoys or risk dystopia. An additional aspect of that, you know, you had the Hague group meeting last week in Bogota with mixed results. They promised concrete measures. I wrote a piece saying, you know, concrete measures or sack of cement, because, again, you know, is it just going to be rhetoric from another city? And there were some, the core members of the Hague group basically said that they were going to get really serious about economic sanctions, which is great, but they didn't really talk about having any kind of force to do that. But just over the last 24 hours, we've seen the Malaysian Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, seem to call for that kind of force, talking about the values we claim to defend, we have to live up to them, and saying that we need to bring relief to Gaza. This is, you know, I mean, we've had boats by activists risking their lives to get in, and of course Israel just, you know, squats them away or blows up the ship. Israel literally blew up a ship called the Conscience about 2 months ago when they were trying to get out of Malta to get to Israel, maybe 3 months ago, and then they stopped another ship with a bunch of activists, including Greta Thunberg. It's ridiculous that nation states and other more major institutions haven't tried to do this. I mean, you contrast this with something like the Berlin airlift, right? When the Soviet Union blocked off Berlin to try to take the city during the height of the Cold War in 1948, the U.S. organized the Berlin airlift in 48 hours. They figured out how they were going to drop food. When Israel invaded Gaza and Sinai along with Britain and France in 1956, Eisenhower put his foot down, got the UN General Assembly to pass a resolution creating the first ever UN peacekeeping force. Within a week, the peace force was created. This happened in November of 1956. By the end of the year, they got them out of Gaza, got them out of Sinai, and they got Israel out of Gaza by the spring. So you have precedents for meaningful international action. And of course, the U.S. uses so-called responsibility to protect whenever it suits it. You know, when it uses, you know, humanitarian intervention as an excuse for good old invasion, whether it's Libya or Yugoslavia or whatever. But here we have a case of bona fide need for responsibility to protect. We have an ongoing genocide, a planned starvation. It's not a natural event. It's not an earthquake. This is planned by the Israeli government in conjunction with the U.S. government. The U.S. government is not complicit here. The U.S. government is a full-fledged partner in crime. And other countries are complicit. So you have the most recent statement from the UN Rapporteur on Food we knew Israel intended to starve Palestinians since October 9th, 2023, when Israel announced explicitly it had plans to do so. And he says there is a famine, quote, there is famine and starvation in Gaza. This creates a mandatory obligations. Countries must act to stop starvation. So it creates a legal obligation for every country in the world to step in and end the starvation and famine in Gaza today. So an increasing number of NGOs, a new organization called Protect Palestine is taking the lead on this. But there are others, Dawn, the group that was founded by Khashoggi, the slain Saudi journalist, has also been imploring countries in the Hague group and otherwise to step in and take action and, you know, like stop the rhetoric. And yes, sanctions are great and overdue, but direct action, whether that is through the UN General Assembly to get around the U.S. veto at the Security Council or other kinds of multilateral action are desperately needed. You are literally seeing people, you know, drop dead in Gaza. You are seeing children starve to death because of the famine that Israel and the United States are engineering for the people of Gaza.
I would not be exaggerating if I said that it appears that the soldiers are using sort of two-year-olds for target practice, and they seem to be enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, what we have is a very, very deeply troubled and racist society, and you have doctors, U.S. doctors coming back from Gaza saying, no two-year-old gets shot in the head twice by accident. You know, that's what we're seeing. We are seeing Israeli snipers, trained, skilled snipers, use those so-called skills to take out very young children. And this has been a massive propaganda effort from the get-go. You know, people might recall in October of 2023, it was all about Hamas, you know, when beheaded babies, and that turned off the brains of a lot of people. Well, they're monsters, and so everything that Israel does is justified. Well, it turns out Hamas didn't behead or slaughter any babies. They killed a bunch of people in an operation that certainly killed civilians, but they made them Israel. It was a concerted effort by the Israeli government and its apparatchiks in the media to so demonize things that the net effect was that Israel lied about slaughtered babies so that it could slaughter babies. That is where we are. This is a genocidal project, and every day they are slaughtering 100 people, and now we're seeing even more ramifications from starvation. And I mean, you have Israel is increasing its attack on fishermen, so that starving Palestinians can't even go and try to get food by fishing. Every method of life support is being taken away. Water is contaminated. I'm seeing reports of people drinking salt water. You can't drink salt water. That's like a death spiral. And obviously the hospitals and schools and other infrastructure has been targeted for these 20-plus months.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Sam Husseini, who has been working as a special correspondent with us. Sam has been trying to ask crucial questions at the State Department. They don't really want to answer those questions, but it's important that we keep asking them. And we're now talking about over 60,000 documented people dead, thousands more wounded, women and children in the majority, and the killing continues. What would the logistics be of putting troops on the ground? Some people are concerned that if there was any attempt, that would give the Israelis more excuses to kill more people.
It well might. There could be several. I mean, whenever there was an edict from the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court against Israel over these nearly going on 2 years now, people noted that Israel would escalate its violence. That's how it responds to, international law, any attempts to apply international law to it. But it responds much the same way to getting carte blanche. Israel will take virtually anything as an excuse to escalate its violence. The issue now is that we're seeing mass starvation. Food needs to get in somehow. Whether that can be done by airdrops, or whether it can be done by ship, or whether it must be done by land with a force that Israel either can't attack for whatever reason, depending on its composition, or won't attack for fear of them being able to defend themselves. I'm not a military strategist, and I have not talked with one about this, but I think that it's significant that you're seeing countries like Malaysia indicate that they may finally be up for this, a great number of or an increasing number of several relief and human rights and other groups calling for it.
You know, this is the most terrible exact example of food being used as a weapon of war. They're literally using, it seems that they're using the food to draw the people closer so that they can kill them.
Yeah, I mean, the cynicism here knows no bounds. They literally set up an organization called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation to say, oh, and they took away, UNRWA and all the other mechanisms, World Food Program. I mean, World Food Program is headed by Cindy McCain, and they're even blowing them off. And of course, they've outright attacked UNRWA, which is a long-time lifeline, very, tenuous lifeline for the Palestinians. Israel demonized UNRWA by torturing employees of UNRWA to saying that they had something to do with the October 7th attacks, and used that as an excuse or part of their excuse to attempt to destroy UNRWA, which was the main lifeline of food, as well as education for the Palestinians in Gaza. Most of them themselves are refugees. These are mostly people who are already driven out of their homes in what is now Israel and put into Gaza, what has been called a open-air prison for many years. And now to move them around over and over again in Gaza, and now they are moving them into ever smaller and smaller places to quote-unquote concentrate them. So they are now establishing concentration camps in order to put people there, and then when they put out food using this phony organization, they literally shoot at people at times when they are attempting to get food. You know, and the U.S. government is pretending that this is a humanitarian endeavor, and the Palestinians are completely desperate. I mean, you're even seeing, you know, mainstream Western organizations, you know, which can't get their own reporters in there, so they've been using Palestinian reporters. So I saw a Turkish news agency do this and Agence France Presse, AFP, do this, basically saying that their reporters who are native Palestinians living in Gaza are starving. So it's even the reporters who are starving.
And the doctors are starving.
Outside source of income.
Yeah.
Sorry?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Sam Husseini. We're talking about the desperate and terrible situation on the ground where food is, among other things, being used as a weapon against the people. And, of course, we're seeing, now, I guess a journalist really has to think about whether they want to put on the shirt that says they're a journalist or leave it off. They might have a better chance of surviving if they don't announce right away that they are a journalist. Anyway, what are you asking people to do? What would you like the people who are listening to this broadcast now, who care about this genocide that is being carried out with U.S. tax dollars, what's the best thing, do you think, for people to do?
Well, there are several things. One is I wrote a piece on my Substack, Husseini.substack.com, that lays out a lot of the information that I just gave, but it also links to how to get in touch with officials from the foreign ministries and the UN missions of various countries that might be likely to do this, to try to encourage these countries to do this. This was the same mechanism that we used to try to get successfully South Africa to invoke the Genocide Convention in December of 2023, which was a landmark in terms of getting global community to understand what Israel was doing. So it's sort of broadening that to not just asking one country to invoke the Genocide Convention, but asking multiple countries to go beyond that and to take action, to approve such action through the UN. The UN General Assembly has passed resolutions calling on states to do things to alleviate the situation, but they're totally nonspecific. They don't spell out sanctions as the General Assembly did during the against apartheid South Africa, and they don't do a peace force as the UN General Assembly did in 1956. But individual countries can be petitioned to back that effort or to do it multilaterally or even unilaterally outside the United Nations. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, obviously we have Congress, which is funding this atrocity. I was just on Capitol Hill today and trying to do what I could there. And now they're heading back to the home districts. So people getting in front of even so-called good members of Congress, nobody in Congress is doing all that they can do. All right. There are mechanisms whereby, for example, aid could be cut off to Israel if a member of Congress would step forward and say, under the Glenn Symington Amendment, the U.S. government is not supposed to fund any country that that is a nuclear weapons proliferator. Israel is a nuclear weapons proliferator twice over. It got nuclear weapons illegally, and it got apartheid South Africa. It enabled them to get nuclear weapons illegally, and then, of course, South Africa got rid of their nukes after they stopped being an apartheid state. Any member of Congress could use this. It has been used. A nonprofit, Grant Smith, very enterprising researcher, tried to use this to cut off funding to Israel. And he wasn't able to succeed. The courts said, we can't do this because you don't have standing. But a member of Congress would have standing. And he sent letters to all of the usual suspects, all the people who say that they're critical of Israel, from Barbara Lee to Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC and Joe Paul and so on. And none of them responded to that. And then I wrote an article doubling down on it and asking them, you know, will you acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons and will you use this legal strategy? So there really is a performative aspect to what a lot of people do. When they and we just saw, you know, AOC and most of the Democrats in Congress vote for the so-called Iron Dome thing, saying that it's defensive, so it's okay, even though it enables the Israeli military. And, you know, we've had, you know, a huge infusion of weaponry to Israel during this period, as it's carrying out a genocide. So I think that action of that sort is important. I also on my webpage put out, I don't know if you've ever featured them on the show, Dennis, Palestine Action, a group that started in Britain doing direct action of literally going into weapons makers that were funneling weapons to Israel and smashing stuff up, and very successfully. and the U.S., the British government is now clamped down. You can't even like wear a Palestine Action T-shirt in England now without getting arrested. England doesn't have
the First Amendment. Yep.
We do. Yeah.
Amazing.
So, you know, it's daunting, but there are things that different people are attempting to do. And, that, you know, even if people can't do those various things, they should look around their circumstance and see and be inspired as to what they can do.
All right. Well, listen, Sam Husseini, as always, we really appreciate the good information and the work you've been helping us do to cover this subject. It's invaluable, and we will keep on this until either they get rid of us or something changes, because there is a U.S.-supported, violently supported genocide that continues to expand in Gaza, where there is a series of concentration camps being used against the people. Thanks, Sam, for taking the time out to be with us. How can people, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Well, if they go to Husseini.org, H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I.org, they'll see my Substack at the top of that. If they want to contact me directly, I don't do this too often, but I'll do this for your listeners, samhusseini@gmail.com, samhusseini@gmail.com. Thank you so much, Dennis, for all you're doing, and I'm sure what a lot of your listeners are doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam Husseini. We appreciate it. We will talk to you soon.
And that is from Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. You can see Sam Husseini's most recent clash with administration's State Department flunky at Decensored News. You can find it through X Twitter if you want to go to Sam Husseini's site. And again, he's been advocating for the General Assembly to use provisions that they can to initiate a variety of things, of actions, a peacekeeping force perhaps, and getting around the Security Council. Okay, since I'm playing all of the Ilan Pape that I can get in an hour tomorrow, I don't feel too bad about playing this excerpt as a bit of a teaser. Ilan Pape's most recent book is called Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. It's incredibly comprehensive, 600 pages. This was recorded in the UK. Going to maybe excise some of the UK-related material, though it is pretty fascinating. And recorded in Hackney at a place called Earth with a capital H. I assume that is for Hackney. It's a interesting borough in London. I happened to see the Arrow play a concert there a long time ago in Hackney Downs. Aaron Bastani is the interviewer. 700 people or so attended this event in see Ilan Pape. Again, it's about 4 months ago, so it would be completely different given the tenor of the times. The title of it is How Israel Became a Fascist State. And again, I will turn it over to Aaron Bastani. A question to the great Israeli living in the UK at Exeter College, I guess, author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, among other books.
Manufacturer of consent for that. So presumably, without the abuse of Holocaust memory, that, do you think that simply wouldn't be possible? You wouldn't be able to execute that kind of strategy?
I don't know, because it is so central to this whole issue that maybe they would have found other methods to do it, but they would have recruited anti-Semitism anyway for that. You know, it's very important to understand that ever since, I would say, the 1930s, first the Zionist military structures, and then after 1948, the Israeli army, was working very hard to convince soldiers, and think about 1948 in particular, when they were attacking the enemy, the Palestinians, they were not attacking an army. They were attacking a village with all the population in it. Now, some of the people who were part of the troops were themselves Holocaust survivors. Now, how do you convince them that the right thing to do is go into Deir Yassin or any other village, massacre children, babies, women, and men, and believe that this is self-defense and this is necessary? The political officers of these units, as we know, used to ignite the enthusiasm of these soldiers by making sure that they associate a Palestinian village with Nazism, a Palestinian national movement with Nazism. I can give you two very good examples of how this manipulation is working in Israel in a very powerful way. Almost every Israeli household has something called the Encyclopedia of the Holocaust. Now, the first biggest entry is Hitler, which makes sense. The second longest entry is Haj Amin al-Hussein, the Palestinian leader of the 1940s. The second longest entry. So the message is very clear. Or some of you might remember Menachem Begin in 1982 comparing Yasser Arafat in a bunker in Beirut to Hitler in the bunker in Berlin. But these are just two examples of this. You needed to dehumanize the native, the indigenous, in order to convince your own troops and people to genocide, to ethnic cleanse, and so on. Now, it's not an exceptional case in history, Aaron. It's not an exceptional case. To convince European refugees to slaughter Native Americans or Native Australians, you also needed to dehumanize the indigenous population, to say that they're not really human beings, they're savages. And therefore you can do what you do, whether even to the children and so on. So it's a version of that. I think for the case of Israel, it was important not just to dehumanize as conventional settler colonialist movement would dehumanize the natives in order to justify the genocide or removal or imposing on them apartheid. You also needed to add something else to make it sure, because you were worried that maybe Jews who were refugees from Europe would find it a bit too much what they were supposed to do in order to build a state, because it was very clear that it was not a land without people, waiting for the people without land. It was land full of people who were building their own life and future. And the only way that people saw it was like a zero-sum game. Either they are there or we are there. And to obliterate them, you know, you needed this kind of dehumanization. But I think in the case of the Israeli education, the dehumanization had to go with the Nazification of the Palestinians. We had this bizarre example when Benjamin Netanyahu, I think it was still with Theresa May, trying to convince her that it was the Mufti who gave Hitler the idea of the Holocaust and things like that. I mean, okay, that's even for Israeli was going too far. But nonetheless, it comes from the same place.
Yeah.
It comes from the same place. Totally delegitimizing a totally legitimate anti-colonialist struggle against a settler colonial project. So how do you delegitimize it? You say it's a continuation of the old anti-Semitic tradition of Europe and the worst part of that tradition. How do people try to silence us here in Britain when we support Palestinians? They call us Holocaust deniers. It's the IHRA, the famous IHRA definition. So it's the same structure. It's a kind of believing that you can use that the memory of that horrible event in Europe to justify the behavior towards the Palestinians and to silence those who support the Palestinians. The fact that we all here probably see it so clearly is not surprising, but the fact that our politicians don't see it, or they see it and ignore it, is beyond comprehension.
I think that's really clarifying, saying that the sort of transposition of Nazism onto the figure of the Palestinian and the memory of the Holocaust and the abuses of that memory, those two things are utterly necessary. They're fundamental in the reproduction of the Israeli state, and it cannot continue to be reproduced without those things, because it's constant, right? That makes it very explicable. I have one question for you, building on what we've already talked about. Obviously, you've got a tremendous archive of historical knowledge about all this stuff.
That's Aaron Bastani. And he's positing another question to Ilan Pape. I'll be playing most all of that segment tomorrow. It's pretty and amazing stuff. I've got his book, and it's difficult. Okay. I guess I'll do some further introductions of that tomorrow. Let's do an underwriting announcement. Maybe I can get a device to cooperate here. Radio for Labor coming up.
Programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com.
Thanks, Cope. Cope Cumston has some of the segments from the Summer of Solidarity events, the one that was at the Rose Bowl. There's another one coming up 1st of August or so. Check your local listings. Again, the segment from the UK was from a YouTube program called Downstream Clips, Aaron Bastani. And that's all I can get for you right now. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. We're going to kick it with the Funkadelics.